We continue with dynamic risk management. I give the floor to Ross.
Thank you very much. Today we will be discussing agenda paper 4B and agenda paper 4C. I propose that we discuss agenda paper 4B first, and then we move on to agenda paper 4C. Agenda paper 4B discusses the proposed qualifying criteria applicable to financial liabilities used when defining the target profile. Furthermore, this paper discusses designation and de-designation of items within the target profile and some documentation requirements. Staff intend to walk through the entire paper and then ask the board the various questions in sequential order. During the previous board meeting, it was tentatively decided that the staff should continue developing the DRM model based on the following: that the target profile represents management's objective for a given asset profile, that the entity's risk management strategy should define the target profile considering, firstly, the contractual terms of financial liabilities, and secondly, the entity's approach to core demand deposits where present. Agenda paper 4B provides the staff recommendations for qualifying criteria for the financial liabilities considered when defining the target profile. While the staff recognize the objective of the model is not to govern, but reflect risk management in financial reporting, the staff believe some qualifying criteria are required for the reasons stated in paragraph 7. In paragraphs 10 through 23, the staff discuss qualifying criteria for financial liabilities within the DRM model. These criteria are similar to the qualifying criteria proposed for the asset profile. The staff's preliminary view is summarized in paragraphs 24 and 25. The staff discuss core demand deposits in paragraphs 26 through 32, with the staff's preliminary view summarized in paragraph 33. I would like to pause here to remind the board of the agreed approach to develop the core areas of the model first and then seek feedback to test the model. Given the importance of demand deposits, this will likely be an area considered during outreach. The staff have proposed qualifying criteria for which financial liabilities would be eligible to be considered as core demand deposits within the DRM model. The staff have proposed these criteria because it should help entities avoid treating financial liabilities as core demand deposits inadvertently or inappropriately. For example, consider the scenario where an entity treats a five-year fixed-rate interest-bearing term deposit as a core deposit. The entity would define the tenor as 3 years based on its risk management strategy. However, such an approach misrepresents the economics, as the interest cash flows from the term deposit are known and the tenor is not 3 years, it is 5 years. The staff believe the proposed criteria should help avoid such misrepresentations. The staff would highlight that not all financial liabilities that meet the criteria stated will be perpetual in nature. There are numerous methods to determine the stickiness of core demand deposits. There are also numerous methods to determine the amount of deposits that can be considered core from a risk management perspective. Both are determined considering customer behavior in addition to the regulatory environment in which the entity operates. Both customer behavior and regulatory environments are jurisdiction specific and are therefore varied. Given this, the staff are concerned that additional qualifying criteria, other than those proposed in paragraph 28, could be arbitrary and would govern risk management rather than reflect its impact in financial reporting. Therefore, the staff are of the preliminary view that the entity's risk management policies and procedures will ultimately define the amount of fixed-rate financial liabilities with a demand feature that can be treated as a core demand deposit, as stated in paragraph 33, as long as they have a demand feature and do not reprice with market interest rates over time. If the classification as core is determined to be incorrect, there will be an economic impact, and therefore there should be an impact in performance. The staff intend to discuss the performance implications in a future board meeting. The staff would comment the requirements discussed in paragraphs 34 onwards in the paper are very similar to those discussed when the board discussed the asset profile in February. Paragraphs 34 through 40 discuss designation and propose that it should be completed on a portfolio basis. The staff preliminary view is summarized in paragraph 41. Paragraphs 42 through 50 discuss designation of proportions of portfolios in addition to designation of future transactions. The staff preliminary view is summarized in paragraphs 51 and 52. Paragraphs 53 through 55 discuss de-designation, when it should occur, with the staff's view summarized in paragraph 56. And finally, the staff have listed documentation requirements in paragraphs 57 and 58. This provides a summary of the paper. I'll now move on to the specific questions within the paper and ask the board for comment. Question number one on qualifying criteria. Does the board agree with the staff preliminary review regarding the qualified criteria as described in paragraphs 24 and 25?
Amaru?
Yes. So we are doing question by question, right? So only on the question one then. Oh, I do agree we have to have qualifying criteria. I think the what you stress on 24, paragraph 24 A to E, are the ones that are at this stage. I just reinforce my agreement with two aspects that you mentioned in the paper. One is the tension, as you describe in paragraph 8. I think we should be very careful in order to keep the objective of DRM and the accounting model sensible in terms of response to the original objective of the project. So I think we are in the right direction, but I do agree with the your warning here. And also on paragraph 16, when you mentioned at the very end, the further consideration might be required on transition. I think we should be really careful about how we'll go into the transition for the model. Apart from that, those aspects. I have only one additional comment. Is on how we are describing forecast transaction firm commitments. I know that you brought the expression as you heard the feedback from the board, but when I read, it made me, at least when I translate to my understand, more confusing than clarifying, because I understand forecast transactions should be highly probable, but a firm commitment is a firm commitment, so I don't think it's really attach it to the high probability if it's a firm commitment.
Sue?
I agree with where you're landing. I just had one question to be sure I understood something and one thing to flag for the transition point. So in 24D, you make the point that to be eligible, it can't already be designated for a hedge accounting relationship for interest rate risk, which I can understand. But that would mean, for example, that you could have a single instrument which is, say, designated for hedge accounting under the normal requirements for, say, foreign currency risk, but included in here for the rate risk aspects. So we'll just have to think about how that interaction works.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good. Yes.
And then on the transition, just one thing to flag. So my understanding would be that, say, for example, we have to look at it, but I'm guessing what you're alluding to is that if, for example, you'd had a liability in the past where the entity had chosen to measure it at fair value through profit or loss, we might want to consider them being able to, on transition, sort of de-designate that election and to move it back into amortized costs so that it could then come in scope here. Just one thing we'll need to think about if we're talking about that is the fact that the own credit requirements don't allow recycling, so we'll need to think about what we do with the bits sitting in OCI for those instruments.
Thank you. And, Ross and team, very well-written papers and repo and so on. And same paragraph where Sue was in 24A, and we'll take 24A and 24D together. And it's really just testing understanding. I understand financial liabilities should be measured at amortized cost. But you go down to D, you say they're not designating the hedge relationship. But what would be so awful about if I had a variable rate financial liability and I had an interest rate swap and created to a fixed rate? Now, is there a conceptual issue or is it just impractical as a portfolio and you really realistically can't do one-on-one hedging? What's the reason why? I don't necessarily disagree with the result, but I'm just not clear on the logic.
I think our concern is double counting. If you're going to manage the interest rate risk of the floating rate exposure in your example, then you should designate it within the model and manage it in that manner. To manage it on a one-to-one basis and then say I'm also going to manage it on a portfolio basis would be two times the hedge. But I think that concern is simply double counting.
But you know, sometimes people do multiple hedges on the same underlying, and then in fact later on swap the variable hedge back to a fixed and so on. So I understand your answer. So it's it was less the double counting as opposed to conceptual.
Yeah.
It's also a practical issue too.
Yeah.
These are a portfolio, and you want to hedge a macro portfolio as opposed to one on one.
Just one Just on that hedge accounting point, though, so in 9 now you can designate as a hedge a combination of a hedging instrument and a hedged item. The sort of net cash flows, if you like, can then be hedged in a new hedge accounting relationship. So that wouldn't be contemplated here, that you could have initially an interest rate hedge that switches it from, I don't know, initially you've changed it from floating to fixed for some reason.
Yep.
Now I take those two cash flows and say that in combination, that's the sort of fixed rate flow cumulatively, and therefore it comes into the model and gets hedged as part of the dynamic.
I think our thinking was that the original exposure should be in the concept of asset transformation will enable you to transform this, per your example.
Speak louder. Sorry.
The example provided, the concept of asset transformation that we've been mentioning about would facilitate the risk management objective there, so I'm not sure why we wouldn't just use it.
So the answer is no, yes.
Okay. Can we just make sure that we're confident on that, though, that definitely has to be at the outcome, because given that in 9 we decided that there could legitimately be situations where you do a chain of things from a risk management perspective, and that we would respect each step as a separate thing. Maybe just double check the logic.
Okay.
We will. The other thing is, this will come back when we come into the derivative side of things also, Sue, because I don't think we're precluding it. It will be done through the target profile going forward, not at inception when we designate. You could do the transformations, but we will come through that in the derivatives. Yes, fair point.
Martin?
I mean, I agree with the staff recommendation because, man, if we have this criteria on the asset side, why we should differ on the liability side? But only one question, man, I know that equity is not a liability maybe, but does it also mean that we excluding with this paper also that people can design an equity portion of in funding of this kind of element, or do we discuss it in a later stage?
In the phase 2, Martin, because equity will have to come in, as you rightly point out, it will be the target profile. Yep. It will be included, okay. But in phase 2 when we look at it.
Yeah. We'll discuss its inclusion in phase 2.
But it will be part of the TP, yes.
Okay.
So can we vote on question 1?
Yeah. All in agreement with the clarification, we will keep in mind the own credit going forward.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, question 2. Core demand deposits. Does the board agree with the staff preliminary view regarding core demand deposits in the DRM accounting model, more specifically the criteria proposed, the absence of other qualifying criteria focused on estimation, and that incorrect classifications should be considered when we discuss performance?
Ken Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Generally, I agree with staff's proposal. I also agree that if an entity inappropriately treated deposits as core demand deposit should be captured in the performance assessment. It's no problem. But I'm also thinking that whether in the first stage we should bring some discipline, try to avoid the entity to treat those deposits as core deposit. Core demand deposit inappropriately. Currently, we bring a clear definition here, but without any additional qualifying criteria because of the easy of the behavior reason, because of the regulator requirement reason. I agree. Mm. Yeah, and it's that behavior or regulator concern there, issue there. But I'm always thinking that without any qualifier criteria, whether it is possible for us to develop some very principle-based, generally discipline, such as those methods and assumptions they use should be based on those reasonable or supportable information available or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think we should have this kind of discipline first stage, not leave the issue to be dealt with at the performance assessment at that stage. I think at that stage, it's quite late. I think we should have some kind of discipline in the first place beyond the definition.
Okay, let's go through. Thanks. Amaru?
Thanks, Hans. I think suggestion by Jean Chow is quite sensible. It's important for that because I'm considering this will be fairly documented. Yes. Based on the DRM, internal DRM, approved by the rightful level within the organization, so the reasonable supportable would be within, in my view, this whole documentation requirement. I have only one comment for you to think about. On the second condition, about not repricing and bringing an experience that might be a local experience, but the case of Brazil, we do have a kind of demand deposit that is repriced, not at the same level of the market risk, of the market interest rate. It's lower, it's repriced, but it's yet demand, under demand. So it's one day, there is no term for the deposit. So when we, and entities generally consider them as their core components in terms of deposits or of resources. So I understand the objective here, but I just suggest you to think a little bit about how can we eventually address the issue of the demand deposits that do have some pricing.
Sure.
I agree generally with where you're heading with this. I just wanted to make sure I know exactly what you're going to ask me to vote on. So if I look at, so if you were to put in update that we'd agreed with paragraph 28, I would say that's part of it, but it's not sufficient, because presumably we mean that you definitely, well, put it around the other way. I'd say you can't consider something to be a core demand deposit if it's, unless it's got a demand feature and it doesn't reprice with changes in market interest rate risk. But we still do want them to be making some sort of determination that it's appropriate to consider it to be core, and that it's appropriate to think about it as being akin to a fixed rate thing. So I feel like we're missing some sort of objective or something here. It's not enough that it's on demand and that it's not repricing. They also need to have determined some way or other that this has got particular characteristics that mean that from a risk management perspective they consider it to be akin to a sort of fixed rate, well, to a fixed rate type liability. So I feel like we're missing at least some sort of objective or something to do with the fact it needs to be determined to be core from a risk management perspective in addition to having these features.
Yeah, can I just, I think after the comment, some of the comments, I'll just try and see if I can rephrase it a little bit, so we could have done it better. Those two features determine the population of liabilities that meet the demand deposits. Then you have to determine which element of that is core. And that is the bit that's determined by customer behavior, regulation, and other things. And they're, of course, reasonable and supportable. Absolutely fair. We'll bring that in, Jin Chao. That's the bit which we are asking the board, that are you happy for us to do it? And of course, any changes in those assumptions, which determines the core and non-core element of that, will affect performance.
I think that's a better articulation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because 28 is really telling you what's a demand deposit.
Then
you've got to determine what's core. Yes. And you're asking us to agree that it's okay for that to be something that's based on, I don't know, risk management type thinking rather than us setting up criteria.
Exactly. I think that's a better way. Sorry, we didn't hit us when we were writing the paper.
Mary?
Core demand deposits, it took me a while to realize that what we're talking about here is a specified amount that you expect to have without regard to who the customers were, whether it was the amount that Sue deposited when she opened the account. So, and as I've thought about it, if that's the way, you know, that's the only operational way of approaching this, that your recommendation that there are no constraints means that we expect in many cases what an institution would be saying is that I have 1,000 of deposits that meet the criteria in 28, and I expect that I will always have at least 700, say, you know, if It doesn't matter if it's from an entirely different group of customers, you know, all my original customers left and all new ones came in, that I will never fall below 700 in my demand deposits. And if that is the basis on which we are permitting somebody, you know, maybe in one jurisdiction or in one case, they're saying it's related to certain customers. It actually matters if it's Ross and Kumar and Sue, you know, as opposed to just any customers. You know, we're not prohibiting them from doing it that way, but I think we've got to make very clear for people giving us feedback that this is as low a hurdle as what's the amount that you expect to have without any identification associated with it.
It's also duration, right?
It's also what?
The duration.
So I expect to have 700 around for
X years.
3 years, 5 years, five whatever. Years.
So both of these elements have to be determined on the basis of risk.
But it's making the point that it's just an amount. It's not any kind of traceability to, and I understand why it wouldn't be, to deposits made on, what's today's date, April 24th or whatever, you know, 25th. It is to, it is just an amount. It could even be in my Leeds branch as opposed to my London branch.
We can clarify.
We can clarify.
Doc. Thank you. Amaro has said in Brazil there are some deposits which relate to the market interest rate, and the same demand deposit we have in Japan. So in various jurisdictions, there are various demand deposits, and some of them are quite relating to the market interest rate, but it's much slower than the market volatility. So therefore, I quite agree with Jin Chao with discipline, and especially we have to be careful about the economic environment. If the economic environment, like today, relatively stable, we can assume it's something like a core demand deposit. But once the economic environment changed, it may change dramatically in one day. So therefore, the discipline, when we make a discipline of artificially segregate core and non-core, we have to take into consideration the future economic environment change. So that is the discipline we need to incorporate.
Fair point.
Martin?
Yeah, also, I agree with that, but I also agree with Sue said. I think we need some kind of qualifying criteria, what is core, what is not core, and then, okay, also what you said, okay, is okay, we need a kind of reasonable, supportable maybe criteria saying, okay, when a company comes up with, okay, what is core, it should be reasonably supportable on past experience, whatever, because otherwise I think it we're missing something. And again, also with this kind of what is in 28B, with the price changes, when we have the same in Germany, I think what distinguished core or non-core is, okay, so we don't have a contractual right that your rate is changing with market rates. And that is, I think, is then a core, and there is a discretion by the bank often, okay, if market rate changes, they provide some interest on demand deposit, which is very, very slow, and that change a little bit. But there is not a contractual right to change that. And I think that is the distinguishing factor here. And if you say only not changing, I think that is not sufficient. There's no contractual rights that it change or not in the contract terms. Otherwise, we will exclude that, and which would not be appropriate, I think.
Just what I found interesting about this proposal, which I understand is the core of the whole system, is that you can see deposits as core deposits and assign stickiness to them on the precondition that they are available on demand, which is, of course, a huge internal contradiction of the model and also shows how accommodating this kind of accounting is, because it works as long as it works, but we know from recent history that it doesn't always work that way. Something to keep in the background.
It's based on expectations.
Yeah.
It's not unique.
But I think
we need to have something around what it is that, from a risk management's perspective, what is it that they're thinking about these deposits that makes them core? And I don't know how. But I think we need to articulate that somehow.
And I think the point links to Tuck's point that it is about the future economics that we knew you need to think about when you make the assessment.
No, but a lot of accounting is based on expectations, but normally it starts with contractual right. And here we do something that is very different from the contractual rights. And I think we have to be completely explicit about that. And
Yeah, but we want to reflect risk management. Yeah. And risk management is based on, expectations.
I understand this.
That we want to reflect in accounting.
But I think it's the same thing for me. For people who haven't worked in this world, you have to be really explicit about where their assumptions are or there's discretion so that people understand what they're buying into.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can I just quickly just make one point? Being one of the gating criteria, we will certainly put this in the outreach, as we said, because this will be important to see whether jurisdictions actually can use the definition. So we will certainly put that in there. Any other comments, or can I just quickly summarize before a vote?
Yeah.
What we are proposing is that we will change the thing as I articulated what qualifies as a demand deposit, and then the criteria for what of that qualifying item can be treated as core. What we are proposing is that that be based on risk management strategy and, of course, be reasonable and supportable. And that's what we are proposing, and, of course, we'll cover that in outreach. And with that, can I...
And we'll make the amendments on 28B regarding contractual repricing.
Yeah. Is everybody happy with that? Can we ask for a vote? All in favour, Hans?
No.
Okay, one again.
You've been drunk. You just want to be contrary.
Okay.
It's my time to be contrary.
Contrary. 13 in favour, one against.
No. 13 in favour, they abstain or against.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Question three. focused on designation. So does the board agree with the staff preliminary view? Designation should occur on a portfolio basis. Section paragraphs 34 through 41 of the paper.
I didn't see that there was any other way to do this. You ask us, are we happy it's on a portfolio basis? What other way would we be doing?
I think I was accused of asking a trick question.
I think yes. I agree with the staff's proposal that the designation of financial liability and future transaction should be on a portfolio basis. In the meantime, I'm thinking that because we are going to vote, what decision we are going to vote, in the meantime, I think the criteria of the portfolio, that means what kind of criteria we should have for those financial liability of future, transaction could be allocated to the same portfolio is also equally important. So I think, as you stated it at paragraph 37, I think those financial liabilities and future transactions should have at least have similar, risk characteristics. So should be included in this decision. I think that's very important because we override what kind of liabilities and the future could be allocated in the same portfolio. That's very important criteria.
We'll include that in Jinchao when we do the update. Okay. That's one of those.
Mary?
I think two points. First is, on the basis of what's here, I'm okay for now. But and the but is just a warning or marker for future, which is I think it's hard for me to understand now before we have a discussion of performance, the extent to which a target profile would be a meaningful benchmark, for determining whether or not you achieve and to the extent to which you have. You're not effective in achieving your goal. Mm-hmm. I don't want to try and get you to explain that now because we've said we're going to talk about it later, but this kind of sets up the, do you agree that this is enough? And until I understand how performance is going to be assessed, it's hard to say, yes, this is enough as the reference point. So okay for now, But I do kind of just have that marker as I want to come back and think about that when we're looking at the context of performance. That's one. And the second, more general one, is I had a bit about core demand deposits. I get it more here, and then it winds up a little more when we come to documentation at the end of this paper, which is one of the things we said early on is that we're going to come back and have a separate discussion about mandatory or elective for this regime. And your paper 4A explains some of the reasons we're doing this project, including concern that there's important information about DRM missing, you know, from the financial statements today, that the activities as an activity set are not faithfully represented. It's challenging at best under the existing model. As soon as we start building in designation, qualifying criteria in the previous section, designation now, and documentation later, in practice, it becomes pretty close to being elective, rather, you know, because if you don't want to do it, you just have to deliberately fail to do one of the things. And I agree with it when looking at the discipline of the model and it producing relevant information, but I think we're going to have to stand back when we get to that discussion about mandatory versus elective. And I do worry a bit, like feeling we're giving away, and I just wanted to kind of put a marker that we need to think about the model as a whole, what we're trying to accomplish in terms of the information needs that we think may not be satisfied today, and whether the model that we build with internal requirements will ensure that everybody has the information that we think is missing. And I just don't want people to take putting in these things as a foregone conclusion on that point.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, I agree with your recommendation. However, could you explain the update in paragraph 9? Which paragraph, Chang-Woo?
39.
As portfolios change on entity update the target profile accordingly, and this is a kind of another designation, de-designation, it's a continuation, it's similar to the concept of rebalance concept. This idea is related to the next paper, the scenario E open portfolio, I guess. So maybe this is the same issue as raised in the asset profile, same thing, but this kind of update is related to future transaction or just some kind of it.
I mean, we'll talk about a couple examples in the next paper, but an update could be related to a future transaction occurring. It could be related to a new origination that's entering the profile. And we don't want to get too much into this because we'll talk about it more in performance. It could relate to a change in assumption. So some kind of updates.
Saying this kind of as a continuation of DRM. Some other updates might be thought as a kind of a stop of the current DRM, and that there is another new designation.
Well, I think there are certain events potentially out there that would say we should continue how they should be reflected in the model. So I'm not sure I'd say that all events are going to be just an update. But I think it's difficult to provide specifics here without really understanding performance in detail. So I don't want to get into what events are going to happen to do what. So.
I agree with the staff recommendation, but Chung Wu's question reminded me of a comment I wanted to make, which is just the – nobody will be surprised I've got a comment on IFRS 9, but the comments we make here on rebalancing, I don't think this is how rebalancing is intended to work in IFRS 9. Rebalancing in IFRS 9 is a very narrow idea to deal with basis risk. If I'm hedging 100 widgets with 105 hedging instruments and then I work out that actually I need 107, it's designed to deal with that type of situation, not where there's changes in the sort of overall size of the group of things that you're... So I just don't want... We should not say this because we might cause problems for people applying IFRS 9.
Understood.
Okay. Can we get a vote?
Yes.
Yeah. You're in favor? Thanks.
14.
Okay. Question 4. Does the board agree with the staff preliminary view that proportions of portfolios can be designated as described in paragraph 51? And then does the board agree with the staff's preliminary views regarding growth as it relates to proportional designation? Very similar to our views on the asset profile.
I just wanted to clarify. I'm pretty sure I know the answer, and but I make absolutely sure I do.
That's an example
of 46 and 47. 47 makes clear that it's a percentage of the liabilities, and I agree with that.
Yep.
46 explains an example where I've actually essentially split my liabilities into two parts. Half is funding my banking book, half is funding an equity book.
Yep.
Now, one way of looking at the description in 46 is that I'm designating 50% of my liabilities. But I don't think that's what you're saying. I think what you're saying is I'm designating 100% of my in-scope liabilities.
That's correct.
Absolutely. Just wanted to make sure
I asked.
In-scope. I could have a lot of other liabilities which are funding, it's fixed assets.
The relevant percentage is the percentage of in-scope liabilities.
Nick.
Thank you. So I'm just asking for some clarification again around paragraph 47. And so throughout the paper, we use the phrases, the entity's risk management policies and procedures, and also the entity's risk management strategy. Are they the same, or is there a subtle difference between those
things? They are not the same.
Can you help me then?
So risk management policies and procedures the risk management strategy will be part of risk management policies and procedures, but the policies and procedures will also have a scope conversation to them as to what the portfolios are that are being managed and some operational considerations as to how data is going to be kind of considered. So the policies and procedures are a much broader set of requirements or documents than the strategy itself. The strategy would be, I want to accomplish X for my...
Okay, but I think a strategy sitting above policy and procedures rather than the way you describe it.
Is that the way 9 does it? Because 9...
makes a distinction which we are not as... considering to bring here because this is at a portfolio level. I don't need that distinction.
Okay. Let's just make sure we're not using the same words to mean something different in two different places.
Yeah. I think that's another reason.
Governance experience lately has meant that policies and procedures are everything.
The strategy has to enter into the policies and procedures here, Nick, because this is what will define, let's say, your core deposit ladder. That's the strategy you want to achieve through your policies and procedures.
Mary was first.
Just a quick request for subsequent meetings and discussions specifically on this point. It would be really helpful for us to have kind of a picture that says, this is what's on top, these are the things that implement it, these are the pieces that sit, you know, have the label and maybe just a brief example, like I'll call it the strategy, and I think that's misusing, as you said. You know, the strategy is to stabilize income over a 3-year period. Kind of, you know, just an example so that we all use the same term.
Thank you.
I like pictures, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah, just with regard to the term, yeah, I think. 52, we say we use the risk management strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And paragraph 57C, we address, I think, the same issue, but we say that the methodology used by the entity to determine the amount of the future transaction and how designation as part of the target profile is consistent with the risk management policies and procedures. Mm-hmm. And when we go to the examples, finally, we also end up risk management strategy. So I think those terms we should be using consistently, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And also looking in 9, risk management strategies is specifically set out as the sort of highest level, so it's the longer term strategy.
Yep.
So it's the highest layer, so yeah.
All right. Okay. All agreed on that?
Subject.
Yeah. Okay.
Last question on this paper. Final question on this paper. Does the board agree with the staff preliminary view that de-designation should occur when the qualifying criteria are no longer met or when the item is de-recognized per the requirements of IFRS 9? And does the board agree with the staff preliminary view that voluntary de-designation should not be allowed as described?
Do we agree?
Agreement 14.
something fishy going on when everybody agrees with everything. That's why I voted against one. But...
We got the dissenting in the most critical one.
Okay. Agenda paper 4C. Agenda paper 4C demonstrates how the dynamic nature of portfolios will impact the asset and target profiles based on tentative decisions to date. The paper demonstrates through a series of hypothetical scenarios, beginning with static profiles and concluding with an open profile, how the dynamic nature will impact the items referenced. Static profiles are those where all future events are identified, documented, and designated at inception. Open profiles consider, in addition, events within the scope of risk management but not necessarily specifically identified at inception. The performance information provided in the scenarios, although brief, is consistent with existing cash ledger accounting mechanics within IFRS standards. Nonetheless, the staff acknowledge that no decisions have been made regarding performance as of yet within the DRM or the DRM accounting model. The staff propose to quickly walk through all the scenarios and then open the discussion for the board. This should better facilitate questions that compare and contrast the various scenarios rather than taking questions on each scenario separately. If the board agrees, I will continue as proposed. Okay. Scenario A highlights how the DRM model would reflect a perfectly aligned portfolio that is defined and finite in length. In particular, it illustrates the termination of the DRM model after the maturity of financial assets, liabilities, and derivatives. Scenario B, in contrast, highlights how the DRM model would reflect a continuous approach to risk management. More specifically, it highlights what would occur after 3 years have passed, if financial liabilities are refinanced, financial assets are reinvested. It also highlights how an entity would align the assets and target profile through new derivatives. Scenario C alters the fact pattern by extending the life of the contractual liabilities and therefore the tenor of the target profile. This has the knock-on effect of requiring the entity to designate a future transaction in the form of reinvestment to achieve alignment. The scenario highlights that if an entity is accurate in their estimation of future transactions, there would be limited impact from the transition from old asset to new asset. Contrasting scenario B and C, it is important to note that different derivatives are required to achieve alignment based on the respective target profiles. Scenario D discusses growth and highlights how an entity must meet the highly probable criteria for both the asset and target profiles. The scenario changes the fact pattern such that the entity is entirely funded by core deposits because designation of growth in other circumstances is considered unlikely as previously discussed. Similar to scenario C, scenario D highlights that if the entity is accurate in its estimation of future transactions, there would be limited impact when growth occurs as designated. Scenario E, an open profile, highlights how future events not specifically designated but nonetheless within the scope of risk management will impact the model. This is done by replicating scenario A, but each year the entity adds a new CU1000 layer of three-year financial assets and financial liabilities. This highlights the layered nature of the target profile and also the relationship between the specific layers and the derivatives required for alignment. However, the staff would reference paragraph 59, where we highlight tracking is likely required to ensure a faithful representation and performance given the difference in contractual terms of the various derivatives described. More specifically, while in scenarios A, C, and D, and B as well, all derivatives were executed at T0, this is not the case in scenario E. Derivatives will be executed at T0, T1, and so on and so forth. And given they will not be identical, some specificity in tracking is required for a faithful representation of performance. Such tracking can be involved and complicated from a data perspective, but the staff would comment that entities have already developed processes to complete tracking, at least to some extent, given it is required for accurate risk management. With that, I'll turn it over to the board if there are any questions on anything within paper 4C.
Being brave going first, but I'm not going to get into the complexities of the different scenarios. I want to comment about a couple of, I'll call them aha moments that I had when I was looking at, for example, page 5, and, you know, explaining how the, you know, the chart that sets out how maturity is, net interest income is stabilized over the target period. And that is, you know, you explain in paragraph 13 that basically interest will be 1% over the 3-year period. That calculation of interest of 1% over the three-year period includes a piece of the change in value of derivative that is recognized as if it were interest income or expense rather than as change in fair value of the derivative. And I think that's implicit in everything that, you know, you've done in other meetings and that you've done throughout all these models. I think it's an assumption on your part that that's how we have to present it, that we're taking the total change in fair value of the derivative and disaggregating it into a piece that we are, we're saying, what is the calculation of interest driver in here? And I'm going to report that as if it were interest income. And then the rest of it is change in fair value of the derivative. I think we need to, again, bring that out so people who are maybe not as familiar with this are recognizing that that's one of the pieces that we're doing, because it means that interest income would have in it a piece that isn't actually receipt or payment of an amount that is interest as such. It's the interest component driver of the change in value of the derivative. And it's not an objection to that. It's just saying we have to be explicit about that and make people focus on it and say, I agree or I disagree in terms of combining it. And the second thing is it made me think a bit more about what are other changes in drivers of the value of the derivative. Because we've said so far that the derivative that we use could not be dominated by credit risk.
We have not.
Okay, we have not. So no, we've said that in respect of the assets that are in the portfolio, but not the derivative. And I think we need to have a discussion, not today without a paper, about any limits on the characteristics of the derivative that's used to transform, if any, because I think we've gone through assuming that the only derivatives people are going to use are interest rate swaps, which is the basic example that we've been illustrating. But do we mean to limit it to those, or are we going to consider other things? And if so, if it's other things, then it's that they're more complex instruments than interest rate swaps that may have other drivers of value change. Is it appropriate to put all of the changes in value in OCI, apart from the piece that's being reclassified as interest, or do we need limits on the types of derivatives? So that the working through these examples and showing how it was stabilized, NIM was stabilized in different periods, made me focus on that, and that's why I just want to make those two questions for future observations and questions.
Yeah, we'll bring a paper on derivatives, and the other mechanics will certainly become evident when we start discussing the performance of the model, Mary, and that's basic cash flow hedge mechanics, which we will use. It's 101. Yeah.
John Wu.
Thank you. Just a clarification question on paragraph 18. This is related to the first question as I raised on the first paper. So based on the scenario B, there is a rolling strategy. So 3 years later, you are having new target profile and you are buying another swap to hedge it, this kind of thing. So based on this paragraph 18, this is a kind of continuation of DRM rather than the designation. So just wondering what the implication of this rolling stage strategy, if you just continue this DRM, rather than just stop here and make all kind of a settlement, and I'm saying, what the implication on the performance report or balance sheet between these two alternatives, a continuation or a stop of this DRM?
I hate to give the cop-out answer, but I'd like to discuss performance later. But
Okay.
I think we will be separating between a portfolio that has a finite end date, and there will be some requirements there to make sure that at the end of that everything's finished, versus a continuous nature where the tracking is going to be more complicated, to be frank. But beyond that, I'm not sure what else.
As of now, are you asking, Chengu, about the designation, de-designation? What is the meaning of that? And that is more an operational simplicity rather than anything else, because these portfolios are continuous. And if you stop and start a hedge, kind of, although this is not, we are talking about hedging or anything like any kind of measurement, the if you don't make it continuous, there are certain performance implications that come up. We will cover those in detail when we come up with the performance.
Later.
That's it, later. Does that answer part of your question? Are you asking about anything more specific on the documentation or the continuation?
While I'm reading your nice papers or scenarios, you know, I could follow your examples step by step. That's very convenient. But however, I'm just worrying, you know, why you are showing all kinds of scenarios to us. What your purpose? Do you try to understand what aspects of this DRM? That was the previous, because, you know, after 3 years, you know, there's a swap, that's a terminator, so you are going to recycle of the OCI to POL after first part of this 6-year DRM of the rolling strategy. So that's my interpretation. So I don't know what difference between this rolling strategy of the...
I'm just asking you if you should be right.
You should be. Why we brought this is actually based on board request when we were asked how will the dynamics work.
Yeah. Yes.
Secondly, this sets out the fundamental basis on which we will come to deal with performance.
Right.
Because each of the scenarios will have slightly different performance implications. Believe me, when everything works as beautifully as this, everything is nice. It's when things don't work beautifully is when the performance issue comes in. Mm-hmm. And then the implications for each of these will be slightly different. And that we just needed to set the baseline before we start bringing this. For example, in scenario E, we have come up with the layers things. Yes, if it works, but the challenge with that will be both operational and also from the conceptual, that each layer is a separate tracking. So I have worked in reality with macro fair value hedging where I've seen spreadsheets with 2,000 line items. So we do need to bring in those before we can start having a discussion with the board what simplifications, if any, you will consider or if not consider, what are the performance limits we will consider and not consider. And we need to start changing the parameters in each of the scenarios, Changu. It's a base building. That's why we didn't have any questions for you in this. Mary?
Couple further comments, and you know, something I should have started with, which is I thought it was very helpful to take it in baby steps in terms of saying step, you know, the build up from A to E, because I think if you just had started by dropping scenario E on me, I wouldn't have appreciated how it differs and what the different pieces are. And I think it was also helpful in understanding in respect of scenario E why you have an expectation of traceability between time buckets and specific mitigating derivatives, and therefore why, you know, you have an expectation that you should be able to say the change in value in OCI should be zeroed at this point in time, versus, you know, anticipating a bit the performance discussion, but good work taking the time to break it down and build it up this way, because I think it makes E understandable, at least before you start varying it. Then I'm not so sure. I'm not promising to stay on, you know, that I can follow as we get more complicated. A couple of, I think they're wording things. And again, it may come back to being perhaps a bit more consistent in wording. In, for example, paragraph 55, you talk about the DRM model must consider the differences in contractual term. And I'm not sure what a phrase like consider the differences in contractual term means as opposed to here's what the differences in contractual, the effect that differences in contractual term have. If that's related to performance, we haven't discussed performance, okay. But we seem to vary a bit in our vocabulary between the duration of the liabilities determine the profile, are considered when developing, you know, the profile, et cetera. And I think we've got to be clear and consistent about that. And so, you know, I do have kind of a question about paragraph 55 and the other question. I'm just not sure I'm following the point that you're making is in paragraph 39. I'll ask both questions and then shut up. Is paragraph 39 near the bottom of page 14, it says, the allocations to the respective time buckets within the asset and target profile do not reflect when the transactions are expected to occur. Rather, they reflect the expected impact on the asset profile and the objective of the entity wants to achieve. What does that mean?
perhaps we could have worded this a bit better, but all of these charts here are showing what the asset profile and the target profile, and as we talked, the asset profile and target profile are about repricing and maturity, not origination. And so when we're talking about growth in particular, we're talking about how growth will reprice, okay, not when growth will be originated.
Okay. Another very critical point. Good point, Mary, what you asked. This is, if you look at it in this scenario, the funding is core demand deposit. So you might originate it, but your risk management strategy will put it in different time buckets based on your expectations of managing repricing. That's what we were a bit too cryptic. We will keep that in mind.
And the paragraph 55, what does that mean?
What's 55?
What's the
The DRM model considers the difference in contractual terms when recognizing.
It was just a bit of a leading statement towards performance that.
Okay. That if it's performance, I can hold on.
No, but explain it.
Well, it's just that given that, as Mary kind of pointed out, given as you add up the layers, the derivatives are not. You cannot commingle them. They're not identical. And so we have to have some way to attribute the contractual terms of derivative A differently than derivative B. And so the model has to consider, accommodate, recognize.
Recycling and things. Yeah.
Yep. I'm saying that.
So consider isn't think about it and decide whether I do anything. Consider means reflect the difference. Okay.
Each of the layers will be managed as if this is scenario A.
Okay.
Each layer becomes a separate scenario at the theoretical extremum. And that is why each layer has to have a separate amortizing pattern for it to match. And then if you think of it, if in certain industries cases, and it doesn't have to be banks, it will be every quarter or something when you do an issuance. In a bank, it could also end up being every day because they're raising issuance. So that is what leads to a 2,000-line spreadsheet which is amortizing those balances out, which indirectly comes in today in the macro fair value hedge
account. But that's a really useful capture, remember it, of layering makes each layer scenario A.
So that's going to be an important aspect for us to talk to people about from an operational perspective then.
Yeah.
So they're hoping it's going to be less onerous than that sort of 3,000 line items.
Then we need to understand how
today
why.
It may not be.
Yeah. Something for discussion.
Yes. With the board when we come to performance and also during outreach as well. Sorry? No. What did he say?
not
meant to be public comment.
He said
yes.
Okay.
We don't have any questions.
There's no votes on 4C. It was
to set the baseline. Can I just get one? What we will start doing next, I think we're there, is we will do one paper on derivatives, which we have said we will do. That will be a pretty short paper because we are contemplating swaps, but also contemplating a particular type of swap which we need to discuss, which are basis swaps. That needs to be considered, and then we will move on to performance science.
Okay.
The last bit of the thing. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. We will have lunch until 1:00.